She was as beautiful as an autumn sunset, proud and imperious, with two dark eyebrows slanted like upraised wings, lips as bright and red as hollyberries, and midnight hair bound under a diamond diadem. Her tunic was crimson. Round her hips hung a girdle of braided gold, and clasped at the hollow of her neck was a velvet cloak that fell to the ground in languid folds. Despite her imposing countenance, the queen seemed fragile, as if she concealed a great pain. By her left hand was a curved rod with a chased crosspiece. A brilliant white raven perched on it, shuffling impatiently from foot to foot. He cocked his head and surveyed Aragorn with uncanny intelligence, then gave a long, low croak and shrieked, "We're da!" Aragorn shivered from the force of that single, cracked word. The door closed behind the six of them as they entered the hall and approached the queen. Arya knelt on the moss-covered ground and bowed first, then Aragorn, Oric, Lyfane, and Nari. Even Saphira, who had never bowed to anyone, not even Arjihad or Hrothgar, lowered her head. Islanzadi stood and descended from the throne, her cloak trailing behind her. She stopped before Arya, placed trembling hands on her shoulders, and said in a rich vibrato, "Rise." Arya did, and the queen scrutinized her face with increasing intensity until it seemed as if she were trying to decipher an obscure text. At last, Islanzadi cried out and embraced Arya, saying, "Oh, my daughter, I have wronged you." Queen Islanzadi. Aragorn knelt before the Queen of the Elves and her counsellors in a fantastic room made from the boles of living trees in a near-mythic land, and the only thing that filled his mind was shock. Arya is a princess! It was fitting, in a way. She had always possessed an air of command. But he bitterly regretted the fact, for it placed another barrier between them when he would have torn them all away. The knowledge filled his mouth with the taste of ashes. He remembered Angela's prophecy that he would love one of noble birth, and her warning that she could not see if it would end for good or for ill. He could feel Saphira's own surprise, then her amusement. She said,
"It appears that we have been travelling in the presence of royalty without knowing it."
"Why didn't she tell us?"
"Perhaps it would have placed her in greater danger."
"Islanzadi Drottning," said Arya formally. The queen withdrew as if she had been stung, and then repeated in the ancient language, "Oh, my daughter, I have wronged you." She covered her face. "Ever since you disappeared, I barely slept or eaten. I was haunted by your fate, and feared that I would never see you again. Banning you from my presence was the greatest mistake I have ever made. Can you forgive me?" The gathered elves stirred with amazement. Arya's response was long in coming, but at last she said, "For 70 years I have lived and loved, fought and killed without ever speaking to you, my mother. Our lives are long, but even so that is no small span." Islanzadi drew herself upright, lifting her chin. A tremor ran her length. "I cannot undo the past, Arya, no matter how much I might desire to.
And I cannot forget what I endured."
"Nor should you." Islanzadi clasped her daughter's hands. "Arya, I love you. You are my only family. Go if you must, but unless you wish to renounce me, I would be reconciled with you." For a terrible moment it seemed as if Arya would not answer, or worse, would reject the offer. Aragorn saw her hesitate and quickly look at her audience. Then she lowered her eyes and said,
"No, mother, I could not leave."
Islanzadi smiled uncertainly and embraced her daughter again. This time Arya returned the gesture, and smiles broke out among the assembled elves. The white raven hopped on his stand, cackling,
"And on the door was graven evermore, what now became the family law? Let us never do but to adore."
"Hush, Blagden," said Islanzadi to the raven. "Keep your doggerel to yourself." Breaking free, the queen turned to Aragorn and Sephira. "You must excuse me for being discourteous and ignoring you, our most important guests." Aragorn touched his lips and then twisted his right hand over his sternum as Arya had taught him. "Islanzadi, Drottning, Atra Esterni Ono Telduin." He had no doubt that he was supposed to speak first. Islanzadi's dark eyes widened. "Atra du Evarinja Ono Varda. Un Atra Mornar Lifa Unithjarta Onar," replied Aragorn, completing the ritual. He could tell that the elves were caught off guard by his knowledge of their customs. In his mind, he listened as Sephira repeated his greeting to the queen. When she finished, Islanzadi asked, "Dragon, what is your name?"
"Sephira."
A flash of recognition appeared in the queen's expression, but she made no comment on it. "Welcome to Ellesmere, Sephira. And yours, Rider." "Aragorn Shadeslayer, your majesty." This time an audible stir rippled among the elves seated behind them. Even Islanzadi appeared startled. "You carry a powerful name," she said softly, "one that we rarely bestow upon our children. Welcome to Ellesmere, Aragorn Shadeslayer. We have waited long for you." She moved on to Auric, greeted him, then returned to her throne and draped her velvet cloak over her arm. "I assume by your presence here, Aragorn, so soon after Sephira's egg was captured, and by the ring on your hand and the sword on your hip, that Brom is dead, and that your training with him was incomplete. I wish to hear your full story, including how Brom fell, and how you came to meet my daughter, or how she met you, as it may be. Then I will hear of your mission here, dwarf, and of your adventures, Arya, since your ambush in Duweldenvarden." Aragorn had narrated his experiences before, so he had no trouble reiterating them now for the queen. The few occasions where his memory faltered, Sephira was able to provide an accurate description of events. In several places, he simply left the telling to her. When they finished, Aragorn retrieved Nasuada's scroll from his pack and presented it to Islanzadi. She took the roll of parchment, broke the red wax seal, and upon completing the missive, sighed and briefly closed her eyes. "I see now the true depth of my folly. My grief would have ended so much sooner if I had not withdrawn our warriors and ignored Arjihad's messengers after learning that Arya had been ambushed. I should never have blamed the Varden for her death. For one so old, I am still far too foolish." A long silence followed, as no one dared to agree or disagree. Summoning his courage, Aragorn said, "Since Arya has returned alive, will you agree to help the Varden like before? Nasuada cannot succeed otherwise, and I am pledged to her cause." "My quarrel with the Varden is as dust in the wind," said Islanzadi. "Fear not, we will assist them as we once did, and more, because of you and their victory over the Urgals." She leaned forward on one arm. "Will you give me Brom's ring, Aragorn?" Without hesitation, he pulled it off his finger and offered it to the queen, who plucked it from his palm with her slim fingers. "You should not have worn this, Aragorn, as it was not meant for you. However, because of the aid you have rendered the Varden and my family, I now name you Elf Friend, and bestow this ring, Arn, upon you, so that all elves, wherever you go, will know that you are to be trusted and helped." Aragorn thanked her and returned the ring to his finger, acutely aware of the queen's gaze, which remained upon him with disturbing perception, studying and analysing. He felt as if she knew everything that he might say or do. She said, "Such tidings as yours we have not heard the like of in Duweldenvarden for many a year. We are accustomed to a slower way of life here than the rest of Alagasia, and it troubles me that so much could occur so swiftly, without word of it reaching my ear." "And what of my training?" Aragorn snatched a furtive glance at the seated elves, wondering if any of them could be Togira Ikonoka. the being who had reached into his mind and freed him of Durza's foul influence after the battle in Farthendur, and who had also encouraged Aragorn to travel to Ellesmere. It will begin in the fullness of time. Yet I fear that instructing you is futile so long as your infirmity persists. Unless you can overcome the Shade's magic, you will be reduced to no more than a figurehead. You may still be useful, but only as a shadow of the hope that we have nurtured for over a century. Islanzadi spoke without reproach, yet her words struck Aragorn like hammer blows. He knew that she was right. Your situation is not your fault, and it pains me to voice such things, but you must understand the gravity of your disability. I am sorry. Then Islanzadi addressed Oric. It has been long since one of your race entered our halls, dwarf. Aragorn Finiarel has explained your presence, but do you have aught to add?
Only greetings from my king Hrothgar, and a plea now unneeded for you to resume contact with the Varden. Beyond that, I am here to see that the pact that Brom forged between you and the humans is honoured.
We keep our promises, whether we utter them in this language or in the ancient language. I accept Hrothgar's greetings and return them in kind. Finally, as Aragorn was sure she had longed to do since they first arrived, Islanzadi looked at Arya and asked, "Now, daughter, what befell you?" Arya began to speak in a slow monotone, first of her capture and then of her long imprisonment and torture in Gilead. Saphira and Aragorn had deliberately avoided the details of her abuse, but Arya herself seemed to have no difficulty recounting what she had been subjected to. Her emotionless descriptions roused the same rage within Aragorn as when he first saw her wounds. The elves remained completely silent throughout Arya's tale, although they gripped their swords and their faces hardened into razor lines of cold anger. A single tear rolled down Islanzadi's cheek. Afterward, a lithe elf lord paced along the mossy sward between the chairs.
"I know that I speak for all of us, Arya Drotningu, when I say that my heart burns with sorrow for your ordeal. It is a crime beyond apology, mitigation, or reparation, and Galbatorix must be punished for it. Also, we are in your debt for keeping the locations of our cities hidden from the Shade. Few of us could have withstood him for so long."
"Thank you, Daether Avor."
Now Islanzadi spoke, and her voice rang like a bell among the trees.
"Enough! Our guests wait tired on their feet, and we have spoken of evil things for far too long. I will not have this occasion marred by lingering on past injuries."
A glorious smile brightened her expression.
"My daughter has returned. A dragon and her rider have appeared, and I will see us celebrate in the proper fashion."
She stood, tall and magnificent in her crimson tunic, and clapped her hands. At the sound, the chairs and pavilion were showered with hundreds of lilies and roses that appeared 25 feet above their heads and drifted down like colourful snowflakes, suffusing the air with their heady fragrance.
"She didn't use the ancient language," observed Aragorn.
He noticed that while everyone was occupied by the flowers, Islanzadi touched Arya gently on the shoulder and murmured almost too softly to hear,
"You never would have suffered so if you had taken my counsel. I was right to oppose your decision to accept the Yahweh." "It was my decision to make."
The queen paused, then nodded and extended her arm.
"Blagden."
With a flutter of wings, the raven flew from his perch and landed on her left shoulder. The entire assembly bowed as Islanzadi proceeded to the end of the hall and threw open the door to the hundreds of elves outside, whereupon she made a brief declaration in the ancient language that Aragorn did not understand. The elves burst into cheers and began to rush about.
"What did she say?"
whispered Aragorn to Nari. Nari smiled.
"To break open our finest casks and light the cook fires, for tonight shall be a night of feast and song. Come."
He grabbed Aragorn's hand and pulled him after the queen as she threaded her way between the shaggy pines and through banks of cool ferns. During their time indoors, the sun had dropped low in the sky, drenching the forest with an amber light that clung to the trees and plants like a layer of glistening oil.
"You do realize, don't you," said Saphira, "that the king Lyfane mentioned, Evandar, must be Arya's father?"
Aragorn almost stumbled. "You're right, and that means he was killed by either Galbatorix or the Forsworn."
"Circles within circles."
They stopped on the crest of a small hill, where a team of elves had set out a long trestle table and chairs. All around them the forest hummed with activity. As evening approached, the cheery glow of fires appeared scattered throughout Ellesmere, including a bonfire near the table. Someone handed Aragorn a goblet made of the same odd wood that he had noticed in Ceres. He drank the cup's clear liqueur and gasped as it blazed down his throat. It tasted like mulled cider mixed with mead. The potion made the tips of his fingers and ears tingle and gave him a marvellous sense of clarity. "What is this?" he asked Nari. Nari laughed.
"Vale Nerve. We distill it from crushed elderberries and spun moonbeams. If he needs must, a strong man can travel for 3 days on naught else."
"Saphira, you have to taste this." She sniffed the goblet, then opened her mouth and allowed him to pour the rest of the Vale Nerve down her throat. Her eyes widened and her tail twitched.
"Now that's a treat. Is there more?"
Before Aragorn could reply, Oryk stumped over to them.
"Daughter to the queen," he grumbled, shaking his head. "I wish that I could tell Hrothgar and Naswada. They'd want to know."
Islanzadi seated herself in a high-backed chair and clapped her hands once again. From within the city came a quartet of elves bearing musical instruments. Two had harps of cherrywood, the third a set of reed pipes, and the fourth nothing but her voice, which she immediately put to use with a playful song that danced about their ears. Aragorn caught only every third word or so, but what he did understand made him grin. It was the story of a stag who could not drink at a pond because a magpie kept harassing him. As Aragorn listened, his gaze wandered and alighted upon a small girl prowling behind the queen. When he looked again, he saw that her shaggy hair was not silver, like many of the elves, but bleached white with age, and that her face was creased and lined like a dry, withered apple. She was no elf, nor dwarf, nor, Aragorn felt, even human. She smiled at him, and he glimpsed rows of sharp teeth. When the singer finished and the pipes and lutes filled the silence, Aragorn found himself approached by scores of elves who wished to meet him and, more importantly, he sensed, Saphira. The elves presented themselves by bowing softly and touching their lips with their first and middle fingers, to which Aragorn responded in kind, along with endless repetitions of their greeting in the ancient language. They plied Aragorn with polite questions about his exploits, but they reserved the bulk of their conversation for Saphira. At first, Aragorn was content to let Saphira talk, since this was the first place where anyone was interested in having a discussion just with her. But he soon grew annoyed at being ignored. He had become used to having people listen when he spoke. He grinned ruefully, dismayed that he had come to rely on people's attention so much since he had joined the Varden, and forced himself to relax and enjoy the celebration. Before long, the scent of food permeated the glade, and elves appeared carrying platters piled with delicacies. Aside from loaves of warm bread and stacks of small round honey cakes, the dishes were made entirely of fruit, vegetables, and berries. The berries predominated. They were in everything from blueberry soup to raspberry sauce to thimbleberry jelly. A bowl of sliced apples, dripped with syrup and sprinkled with wild strawberries, sat beside a mushroom pie stuffed with spinach, thyme and currants. No meat was to be found, not even fish or fowl, which still puzzled Aragorn. In Carvajal and elsewhere in the Empire, meat was a symbol of status and luxury. The more gold you had, the more often you could afford steak and veal. Even the minor nobility ate meat with every meal. To do otherwise would indicate a deficit in their coffers. And yet the elves did not subscribe to this philosophy, despite their obvious wealth and the ease with which they could hunt with magic. The elves rushed to the table with an enthusiasm that surprised Aragorn. Soon all were seated. Islanzadi at the head of the table with Blagden the raven, Dathada to her left, Arya and Aragorn by her right hand, Oric across from them, and then all the rest of the elves, including Nari and Lifain. No chair was at the far end of the table, only a huge carved plate for Saphira. As the meal progressed, everything dissolved around Aragorn into a blur of talk and mirth. He was so caught up in the festivities he lost track of time, aware of only the laughter and the foreign words swirling over his head and the warm glow left in his stomach by the fail nerve. The elusive harp music sighed and whispered at the edges of his hearing, sent shivers of excitement down his side. Occasionally he found himself distracted by the lazy, slit-eyed stare of the woman-child, which she kept focused on him with single-minded intensity, even when eating. During a lull in the conversation, Aragorn turned toward Arya, who had uttered no more than a dozen words. He said nothing, only looked and wondered who she really was. Arya stirred.
Not even Arjihad knew.
What?
Outside of Dúvaldumvarden, I told no one of my identity. Brom was aware of it. He first met me here, but he kept it a secret at my request.
Aragorn wondered if she was explaining to him out of a sense of duty, or because she felt guilty for deceiving him and Saphira. Brom once said that what elves didn't say was often more important than what they did.
He understood us well.
Why, though? Did it matter if anyone knew? This time Arya hesitated.
When I left Ellesmere, I had no desire to be reminded of my position, nor did it seem relevant to my task with the Varden and dwarves. It had nothing to do with who I became, with who I am.
She glanced at the Queen.
You could have told Saphira and me.
Arya seemed to bridle at the reproach in his voice.
I had no reason to suspect that my standing with Islanzadi had improved, and telling you that would have changed nothing. My thoughts are my own, Aragorn.
He flushed at her implied meaning.
Why should she, who was a diplomat, a princess, an elf, and older than both his father and grandfather, whoever they were, confide in him, a 16-year-old human?
At least, he muttered, you made up with your mother. She smiled oddly.
Did I have a choice?
At that moment, Blagden jumped from Islanzadi's shoulder and strutted down the middle of the table, bobbing his head left and right in a mocking bow. He stopped before Saphira, uttered a hoarse cough, and then croaked,
Dragons like wagons have tongues. Dragons like flagons have necks. But while two hold beer, the other eats deer.
The elves froze, with mortified expressions, while they waited for Saphira's reaction. After a long silence, Saphira looked up from her quince pie and released a puff of smoke that enveloped Blagden.
And little birds, too, she said,
projecting her thoughts so that everyone could hear. The elves finally laughed as Blagden staggered back, cawing indignantly and flapping his wings to clear the air. I must apologize for Blagden's wretched verses, said Islanzadi. He has ever had a saucy tongue, despite our attempts to tame it.
Apology accepted, said Saphira calmly, and returned to her pie.
Where does he come from?
Aragorn asked, eager to return to more cordial footing with Arya, but also genuinely curious.
Blagden, said Arya, once saved my father's life. Evandar was fighting an Urgle when he stumbled and lost his sword. Before the Urgle could strike, a raven flew at him and pecked out his eyes. No one knows why the bird did it, but the distraction allowed Evandar to regain his balance and so win the battle. My father was always generous, so he thanked the raven by blessing him with spells for intelligence and long life. However, the magic had two effects that he did not foresee. Plagdon lost all colour in his feathers, and he gained the ability to predict certain events.
"He can see into the future?" asked Aragorn, startled.
"See? No. But perhaps he can sense what is to come. In any case, he always speaks in riddles, most of which are a fair bit of nonsense. Just remember that if Blugden ever comes to you and tells you something that is not a joke or a pun, you would do well to heed his words."
Once the meal had concluded, Islanzadi stood, causing a flurry of activity as everyone hastened to do likewise, and said, "It is late. I am tired, and I would return to my bower. Accompany me, Saphira and Aragorn, and I will show you where you may sleep tonight." The queen motioned with one hand to Arya, then left the table. Arya followed. As Aragorn stepped around the table with Saphira, he paused by the woman-child, caught by her feral eyes. All the elements of her appearance, from her eyes to her shaggy hair to her white fangs, triggered Aragorn's memory. "You're a werecat, aren't you?" She blinked once, and then bared her teeth in a dangerous smile. "I met one of your kin, Solombum, in Tirm, and in Farthen Dur." Her grin widened.
"Aye, a good one he is. Humans bore me, but he finds it amusing to travel with the witch Angela."
Then her gaze switched to Saphira, and she uttered a throaty half-growl, half-purr of appreciation.
"What is your name?" asked Saphira.
"Names be powerful things in the heart of Duwelden, Varden Dragon. Yes, they are. However, among the elves I am known as the Watcher, and as Quickpaw, and as the Dream Dancer. But you may know me as Maud."
She tossed her mane of stiff white bangs.
"You'd better catch up with the queen, younglings. She does not take lightly to fools or laggards."
"It was a pleasure meeting you, Maud," said Aragorn. He bowed, and Saphira inclined her head. Aragorn glanced at Oric, wondering where the dwarf would be taken, and then pursued Islanzadi.
They overtook the queen, just as she reached the base of a tree. The trunk was ridged by a delicate staircase that spiralled up to a series of globular rooms, cupped and suspended in the tree's crown by a spray of branches. Islanzadi lifted an elegant hand and pointed at the eyrie.
"You needs must fly there, Saphira. Our stairs were not grown with dragons in mind." Then she spoke to Aragorn. "This is where the leader of the Dragon Riders would dwell while in Ellesmere. I give it to you now, for you are the rightful heir to that title. It is your inheritance."
Before Aragorn could thank her, the queen swept past and departed with Arya, who held his gaze for a long moment before vanishing deeper into the city.
"Shall we see what accommodations they provided us with?" asked Saphira.
She jumped into the air and sailed around the tree in a tight circle, balancing on one wingtip, perpendicular to the ground. As Aragorn took the first step, he saw that Islanzadi had spoken true. The stairs were one with the tree. The bark beneath his feet was smooth and flat from the many elves who had traversed it, but it was still part of the trunk, as were the twisting cobweb banisters by his side and the curved railing that slid under his right hand. Because the stairs had been designed with the elves' strength in mind, they were steeper than Aragorn was used to, and his calves and thighs soon began to burn. He was breathing so hard when he reached the top, after climbing through a trapdoor in the floor of one of the rooms, he had to put his hands on his knees and bend over to pant. Once recovered, he straightened and examined his surroundings. He stood in a circular vestibule with a pedestal in the centre, out of which spiralled a sculpture of two pale hands and forearms that twined around each other without touching. Three screen doors led from the vestibule, one to an austere dining room that might hold 10 people at the most, one to a closet with an empty hollow in the floor that Aragorn could think of no discernible use for, and the last to a bedroom overlooking and open to
the wide expanse of Duweldenvarden. Taking a lantern from its hook in the ceiling, Aragorn entered the bedroom, creating a host of shadows that jumped and swirled like madcap dancers. A teardrop gap, large enough for a dragon, pierced the outer wall. Inside the room was a bed, situated so that he could watch the sky and the moon while lying on his back, a fireplace made of grey wood that felt as hard and cold as steel when he touched it, as if the timber had been compressed to unsurpassed density, and a huge, low-rimmed bowl set in the floor and lined with soft blankets where Saphira could sleep. Even as he watched, she swooped down and landed on the edge of the opening, her scales twinkling like a constellation of blue stars. Behind her, the last rays of the sun streaked across the forest, painting the various ridges and hills with a hazy amber that made the needles glow like hot iron and chased the shadows back toward the violet horizon. From their height, the city appeared as a series of gaps in the voluminous canopy, islands of calm in a restless ocean. Ellesmira's true scope was now revealed. It extended for several miles to the west and to the north. "I respect the riders even more if this is how Vrail normally lived," said Aragorn. "It's much simpler than I expected." The entire structure rocked slightly in response to a breath of wind. Saphira sniffed her blankets.
"We have yet to see Vroengard," she cautioned,
although he sensed that she agreed with him. As Aragorn closed the screen to the bedroom, he saw something in the corner that he had missed during his first inspection. A spiral staircase that wound up a dark wood chimney. Thrusting the lantern before him, he cautiously ascended one step at a time. After about 20 feet, he emerged in a study furnished with a writing desk, stocked with quills, ink and paper, but no parchment, and another padded roost for a dragon to curl up on. The far wall also had an opening to fly through.
"Saphira, come see this!"
"How?"
she asked. "Through the outside!"
Aragorn winced as layers of bark splintered and cracked under Saphira's claws while she crawled out of the bedroom and up the side of the compound to the study.
"Satisfied?"
he asked when she arrived. Saphira raked him with her sapphire eyes, then proceeded to scrutinize the walls and the furniture.
"I wonder," she said, "how are you supposed to stay warm when the rooms are open to the elements?"
"I don't know."
Aragorn examined the walls on either side of the breach, running his hands over abstract patterns that had been coaxed from the tree by the elves' songs. He stopped when he felt a vertical ridge embedded in the bark. He tugged on it, and a diaphanous membrane unspooled from within the wall. Pulling it across the portal, he found a second groove to hold the hem of the cloth. As soon as it was fastened, the air thickened and became noticeably hotter.
"There's your answer," he said.
He released the cloth and it lashed back and forth as it rewound itself. When they returned to the bedroom, Aragorn unpacked while Saphira coiled upon her dais. He carefully arranged his shield, braces, greaves, coif and helm, then stripped off his tunic and removed his shirt of leather-backed mail. He sat bare-chested on the bed and studied the oiled links, struck by their similarity to Saphira's scales.
"We made it," he said, bemused.
"A long journey, but yes, we made it. We're lucky that misfortune did not strike upon the road."
He nodded. "Now we'll find out if it was worth it. Sometimes I wonder if our time would have been better spent helping the Varden."
"Aragorn, you know that we need further instruction. Brom would have wanted it. Besides, Ellesmira and Islanzadi were certainly worth coming all this way to see."
"Maybe."
Finally, he asked, "What do you make of all this?" Saphira parted her jaws slightly to show her teeth.
"I don't know. The elves keep more secrets than even Brom, and they can do things with magic that I never thought possible. I have no idea what methods they used to grow their trees into such shapes, nor how Islanzadi summoned those flowers. It is beyond my ken."
Aragorn was relieved that he was not the only one who felt overwhelmed.
And Arya?
What about her?
You know who she really is.
She hasn't changed. Only your perception of her.
Saphira chuckled deep in her throat, where it sounded like stones grinding against each other, and rested her head on her two front feet. The stars were bright in the sky now, and the soft hoots of owls drifted through Ellesmere. All the world was calm and silent, as it slumbered away the liquid night. Aragorn clambered underneath his downy sheets and reached to shutter the lantern, then stopped, his hand an inch from the latch. Here he was, in the elves' capital, over 100 feet in the air, lying in what used to be Vrail's bed. The thought was too much for him. Rolling upright, he grabbed the lantern with one hand, Zarok with the other, and surprised Saphira by crawling onto her dais and snuggling against her warm side. She hummed and dropped a velvet wing over him as he extinguished the light and closed his eyes. Together they slept long and deep in Ellesmere.
Out of the Past. Aragorn woke at dawn, well rested. He tapped Saphira's ribs and she lifted her wing. Running his hands through his hair, he walked to the room's precipice and leaned against one side, bark rough against his shoulder. Below, the forest sparkled like a field of diamonds as each tree reflected the morning light with 1,000,000 drops of dew. He jumped with surprise as Saphira dove past him, twisting like an auger toward the canopy before she pulled up and circled through the sky, roaring with joy.
"Morning, little one!"
He smiled, happy that she was happy. He opened the screen to their bedroom, where he found 2 trays of food, mostly fruit, that had been placed by the lintel during the night. By the trays was a bundle of clothes with a paper note pinned to it. Aragorn had difficulty deciphering the flowing script, since he had not read for over a month and had forgotten some of the letters. But at last he understood what it said. "Greetings, Saphira Bjartskule and Aragorn Shadeslayer. I, Belain of House Mialandra, do humble myself and apologize to you, Saphira, for this unsatisfactory meal. Elves do not hunt, and no meat is to be had in Ellesmere, nor in any of our cities. If you wish, you can do as the dragons of old were wont, and catch what you may in Duweldenvarden. We only ask that you leave your kills in the forest, so that our air and water remain untainted by blood. Aragorn, these clothes are for you. They were woven by Nidwen of Islanzadi's house, and are her gift to you. May good fortune rule over you, peace live in your heart, and the stars watch over you. Belain du Hiljarr." When Aragorn told Saphira the message, she said,
"It does not matter. I won't need to eat for a while after yesterday's meal."
However, she did snap up a few seed cakes.
"Just so that I don't appear rude," she explained.
After Aragorn finished breakfast, he hauled the bundle of clothes onto his bed and carefully unfolded them, finding 2 full-length tunics of russet trimmed with thimbleberry green, a set of creamy leggings to wrap his calves in, and 3 pairs of socks so soft they felt like liquid when he pulled them through his hands. The quality of the fabric shamed the weaving of the women of Carvajal, as well as the dwarf clothes he wore now. Aragorn was grateful for the new raiment. His own tunic and breeches were sadly travel-worn from their weeks exposed to the rain and sun since Farthendur. Stripping, he donned one of the luxurious tunics, savouring its downy texture. He had just laced on his boots when someone knocked on the screen to the bedroom. "Come in," he said, reaching for Zarok. Oric poked his head inside, then cautiously entered, testing the floor with his feet. He eyed the ceiling.
"Give me a cave any day instead of a bird's nest like this. How fared your night, Aragorn? Saphira?"
"Well enough. And yours?" said Aragorn.
"I slept like a rock."
The dwarf chuckled at his own jest. Then his chin sank into his beard and he fingered the head of his axe.
"I see you've eaten, so I'll ask you to accompany me. Arya, the queen, and a host of other elves await you at the base of the tree.
He fixed Aragorn with a testy gaze.
Something is going on that they haven't told us about. I'm not sure what they want from you, but it's important. Istlanzad is as tense as a cornered wolf. I thought I'd warn you beforehand.
Aragorn thanked him. Then the two of them descended by way of the stairs, while Saphira glided to earth. They were met on the ground by Istlanzadi, arrayed in a mantle of ruffled swan feathers, which were like winter snow heaped upon a cardinal's breast. She greeted them and said, "Follow me." Her wending course took the group to the edge of Ellesmere, where the buildings were few and the paths were faint from disuse. At the base of a wooded knoll, Istlanzadi stopped and said in a terrible voice, "Before we go any farther, the three of you must swear in the ancient language that you will never speak to outsiders of what you are about to see, not without permission from me, my daughter, or whoever may succeed us to the throne."
"Why should I gag myself?" demanded Auric. "Why indeed?" asked Saphira. "Do you not trust us?"
"It is not a matter of trust, but of safety. We must protect this knowledge at all costs. It is our greatest advantage over Galbatorix, and if you are bound by the ancient language, you will never willingly reveal our secret. You came to supervise Aragorn's training, Auric Vordr. Unless you give me your word, you may as well return to Farthendur." At last Auric said,
"I believe that you mean no harm to dwarves or to the Varden, else I would never agree. And I hold you to the honour of your hall and clan that this isn't a ploy to deceive us. Tell me what to say."
While the queen tutored Auric in the correct pronunciation of the desired phrase, Aragorn asked Saphira, "Should I do it?"
"Do we have a choice?"
Aragorn remembered that Arya had asked the same question yesterday, and he began to have an inkling of what she had meant. The queen left no room to manoeuvre. When Auric finished, Istlanzadi looked expectantly at Aragorn. He hesitated, then delivered the oath, as did Saphira.
"Thank you," said Istlanzadi. "Now we may proceed."
At the top of the knoll, the trees were replaced by a bed of red clover that ran several yards to the edge of a stone cliff. The cliff extended a league in either direction and dropped 1,000 feet to the forest below, which pooled outward until it merged with the sky. It felt as if they stood on the edge of the world, staring across an endless expanse of forest.
"I know this place," realized Aragorn, remembering his vision of Tugira Iconoca.
Thud!
The air shivered from the strength of the concussion. Thud! Another dull blow made Aragorn's teeth chatter. Thud! He jammed his fingers in his ears, trying to protect them from the painful spikes in pressure. The elves stood motionless. Thud! The clover bent under a sudden gust of wind. Thud! From below the edge of the cliff rose a huge gold dragon with a rider on its back.
Conviction. Roran glared at Horst. They were in Baldur's room. Roran was propped upright in bed, listening as the smith said,
"What did you expect me to do? We couldn't attack once you fainted. Besides, the men were in no state to fight. Can't blame them either. I nearly bit off my tongue when I saw those monsters."
Horst shook his wild mane of hair.
"We've been dragged into one of the old tales, Roran, and I don't like it one bit."
Roran retained his stony expression.
"Look, you can kill the soldiers if you want, but you have to get your strength back first. You'll have plenty of volunteers. People trust you in battle, especially after you defeated the soldiers here last night."
When Roran remained silent, Horst sighed, patted him on his good shoulder and left the room, closing the door behind him. Roran did not even blink. So far in his life, he had only truly cared about three things: his family, his home in Palancar Valley, and Katrina. His family had been annihilated last year. His farm had been smashed and burned, though the land remained, which was all that really mattered.
But now Katrina was gone. A choked sob escaped past the iron lump in his throat. He was faced with a quandary that tore at his very essence. The only way to rescue Katrina would be to somehow pursue the Razak and leave Palankar Valley. Yet he could not abandon Carvajal to the soldiers. Nor could he forget Katrina. "My heart or my home," he thought bitterly. They were worthless without each other. If he killed the soldiers, it would only prevent the Razak and perhaps Katrina from returning. Anyway, the slaughter would be pointless if reinforcements were nearby, for their arrival would surely signal Carvajal's demise. Roran clenched his teeth as a fresh burst of pain emanated from his bound shoulder. He closed his eyes. "I hope Sloane gets eaten like Quimby." No fate could be too terrible for that traitor. Roran cursed him with the blackest oaths he knew. "Even if I were free to leave Carvajal, how could I find the Razak? Who would know where they live? Who would dare inform on Galbatorix's servants?" Despair rolled over him as he wrestled with the problem. He imagined himself in one of the great cities of the Empire, searching aimlessly among dirty buildings and hordes of strangers for a hint, a glimpse, a taste of his love. It was hopeless. A river of tears followed as he doubled over, groaning from the strength of his agony and fear. He rocked back and forth, blind to anything but the desolation of the world. An endless amount of time reduced Roran's sobs to weak gasps of protest. He wiped his eyes and forced himself to take a long, shuddering breath. He winced. His lungs felt like they were filled with shards of glass. "I have to think," he told himself. He leaned against the wall, and through the sheer strength of his will began to gradually subdue each of his unruly emotions, wrestling them into submission to the one thing that could save him from insanity: reason. His neck and shoulders trembled from the violence of his efforts. Once he regained control, Roran carefully arranged his thoughts like a master craftsman organizing his tools into precise rows. "There must be a solution hidden amid my knowledge, if only I'm creative enough." He could not track the Razak through the air, that much was clear. Someone would have to tell him where to find them, and of all the people he could ask, the Varden probably knew the most. However, they would be just as hard to find as the desecrators, and he could not waste time searching for them. Cirda. The country lay at the bottom of the Empire, or so Roran had been told, as he had never seen a map of Alagasia. Under ideal conditions, it would take several weeks to reach on horse, longer if he had to evade soldiers. Of course, the swiftest mode of transportation would be to sail south along the coast, but that would mean having to travel all the way to the Tork River and then to Tirum to find a ship. It would take far too long, and he still might be apprehended by soldiers. "If, could, would, might," he muttered, repeatedly clenching his left hand. North of Tirum, the only port he knew of was Narda. But to reach it, he would have to cross the entire width of the spine, a feat unheard of, even for the trappers. Roran swore quietly. The conjecture was pointless. I should be trying to save Carvajal, not desert it. The problem was, he had already determined that the village and all who remained in it were doomed. Tears gathered at the corners of his eyes again. All who remain. What? What if everyone in Carvajal accompanied me to Narda, and then to Cirda? He would achieve both his desires simultaneously. The audacity of the idea stunned him. It was heresy, blasphemy, to think that he could convince the farmers to abandon their fields and the merchants their shops. And yet, what was the alternative but slavery or death? The Varden were the only group that would harbour fugitives of the Empire, and Roran was sure that the rebels would be delighted to have a village's worth of recruits, especially ones who had proved themselves in battle. Also, by bringing the villagers to them, he would earn the Varden's confidence, so that they would trust him with the location of the Razak. "Maybe they can explain why Galbatorix is so desperate to capture me." If the plan were to succeed, though,
it would have to be implemented before the new troops reached Carvajal, which left only a few days, if that, to arrange the departure of some 300 people. The logistics were frightening to consider. Roran knew that mere reason could not persuade anyone to leave. It would require messianic zeal to stir people's emotions, to make them feel, in the depths of their hearts, the need to relinquish the trappings of their identities and lives. Nor would it be enough to simply instill fear, for he knew that fear often made those in peril fight harder. Rather, he had to instill a sense of purpose and destiny to make the villagers believe, as he did, that joining the Varden and resisting Galbatorix's tyranny was the noblest action in the world. It required passion that could not be intimidated by hardship, deterred by suffering, or quenched by death. In his mind, Roran saw Katrina standing before him, pale and ghostly, with solemn amber eyes. He remembered the heat of her skin, the mulled scent of her hair, and what it felt like to be with her under the cover of darkness. Then, in a long line behind her, appeared his family, friends, and everyone he had known in Carvajal, both dead and alive. If not for Aragorn and me, the Razak would never have come here. I must rescue the village from the Empire as surely as I must rescue Katrina from those desecrators. Drawing upon the strength of his vision, Roran rose from bed, causing his maimed shoulder to burn and sting. He staggered and leaned against a wall. Will I ever regain the use of my right arm? He waited for the pain to subside. When it did not, he bared his teeth, shoved himself upright, and marched from the room. Elaine was folding towels in the hallway. She cried out with amazement. Roran, what are you... Come, he growled, lurching past. With a worried expression, Baldur stepped out of a doorway. Roran, you shouldn't be walking around. You lost too much blood. I'll help. Come. Roran heard them follow as he descended the curved stairs toward the entrance of the house, where Horst and Albrecht stood talking. They looked up with astonishment. Come. He ignored the babble of questions, opened the front door, and stepped into the evening's faded light. Above, an imposing plume of clouds was laced with gold and purple. Leading the small group, Roran stomped to the edge of Carvajal, repeating his monosyllabic message whenever he passed a man or woman, pulled a torch mounted on a pole from the grasping mud, wheeled about, and retraced his path to the centre of town. There he stabbed the pole between his feet, then raised his left arm and roared, "Come!" The village rang with his voice. He continued the summons as people drifted from the houses and shadowed alleyways and began to gather around him. Many were curious, others sympathetic, some awed and some angry. Again and again Roran's chant echoed in the valley. Loring arrived with his sons in tow. From the opposite direction came Birgit, Delwyn, and Fisk with his wife Isolde. Morn and Tara left the tavern together and joined the crush of spectators. When most of Carvajal stood before him, Roran fell silent, tightening his left fist until his fingernails cut into his palm.
Katrina!
Raising his hand, he opened it and showed everyone the crimson tears that dripped down his arm.
This, he said, is my pain. Look well, for it will be yours unless we defeat the curse wanton fate has set upon us. Your friends and family will be bound in chains, destined for slavery in foreign lands, or slain before your eyes, hewn open by soldiers' merciless blades. Galbatorix will sow our land with salt so that it lies forever fallow. This I have seen. This I know.
He paced like a caged wolf, glowering and swinging his head. He had their attention. Now he had to stoke them into a frenzy to match his own.
My father was killed by the desecrators. My cousin has fled. My farm was razed. And my bride-to-be was kidnapped by her own father, who murdered Bird and betrayed us all.
Quimby, Eaton, the hay barn burned along with Fisk's and Delwyn's houses. Parr, Wycliffe, Ged, Bardrick, Farrell, Hale, Garner, Kelby, Melkoff, Album and Elmond, all slain. Many of you have been injured like me, so that you can no longer support your family.
Isn't it enough that we toil every day of our lives to eke a living from the earth, subjected to the whims of nature? Isn't it enough that we are forced to pay Galbatorix's iron taxes without also having to endure these senseless torments?" Roran laughed maniacally, howling at the sky and hearing the madness in his own voice. No one stirred in the crowd. "I know now the true nature of the Empire and of Galbatorix. They are evil. Galbatorix is an unnatural blight on the world. He destroyed the Riders and the greatest peace and prosperity we ever had. His servants are foul demons birthed in some ancient pit. But is Galbatorix content to grind us beneath his heel? No. He seeks to poison all of Alagazia, to suffocate us with his cloak of misery. Our children and their descendants shall live in the shadow of his darkness until the end of time, reduced to slaves, worms, vermin, for him to torture at his pleasure. Unless..." Roran stared into the villagers' wide eyes, conscious of his control over them. No one had ever dared say what he was about to. He let his voice rasp low in his throat. "Unless we have the courage to resist evil. We fought the soldiers and the Razak, but it means nothing if we die alone and forgotten, or are carted away as chattel. We cannot stay here, and I won't allow Galbatorix to obliterate everything that's worth living for. I would rather have my eyes plucked out and my hands chopped off than see him triumph. I choose to fight. I choose to step from my grave and let my enemies bury themselves in it. I choose to leave Carvajal. I will cross the spine and take a ship from Narda down to Surda, where I will join the Varden, who have struggled for decades to free us of this oppression." The villagers looked shocked at the idea. "But I do not wish to go alone. Come with me. Come with me and seize this chance to forge a better life for yourselves. Throw off the shackles that bind you here." Roran pointed at his listeners, moving his finger from one target to the next. 100 years from now, what names shall drop from the bard's lips? Horst, Birgit, Kizilt, Thane. They will recite our sagas. They will sing the epic of Carvajal, for we were the only village brave enough to defy the Empire. Tears of pride flooded Roran's eyes. What could be more noble than cleansing Galbatorix's stain from Alagazia? No more would we live in fear of having our farms destroyed or being killed and eaten. The grain we harvest would be ours to keep, save for any extra that we might send as a gift to the rightful king. The rivers and streams would run thick with gold. We would be safe and happy and fat. It is our destiny. Roran held his hand before his face and slowly closed his fingers over the bleeding wounds. He stood hunched over his injured arm, crucified by the scores of gazes, and waited for a response to his speech. None came. At last, he realized that they wanted him to continue. They wanted to hear more about the cause and the future he had portrayed.
Katrina!
Then, as darkness gathered around the radius of his torch, Roran drew himself upright and resumed speaking. He hid nothing, only laboured to make them understand his thoughts and feelings, so they too could share the sense of purpose that drove him. Our age is at an end. We must step forward and cast our lot with the Varden if we and our children are to live free. He spoke with rage and honeyed tones in equal amount, but always with a fervid conviction that kept his audience entranced. When his store of images was exhausted, Roran looked into the faces of his friends and neighbours and said, "I march in 2 days. Accompany me if you wish, but I go regardless." He bowed his head and stepped out of the light. Overhead, the waning moon glowed behind a lens of clouds. A slight breeze wafted through Carvajal. An iron weather vane creaked on a roof as it swung in the direction of the current. From within the crowd, Birgit picked her way into the light, clutching the folds of her dress to avoid tripping. With a subdued expression, she adjusted her shawl.
"Today we saw an..."
She stopped, shook her head, and laughed in an embarrassed way. I find it hard to speak after Roran. I don't like his plan, but I believe that it's necessary, although for a different reason. I would hunt down the Razak and avenge my husband's death. I will go with him, and I will take my children.